Perched on a farm along New York's Hudson River is Chef Dan Barber's award-winning restaurant, Blue Hill at Stone Barns. The food that is harvested there is served to diners daily, which is how Dan Barber became synonymous with the farm-to-table movement. Eventually, though, he noticed that farming and consuming foods locally still isn't all that sustainable.
For example, we're about to head into tomato season, and tomatoes are the all-star of the farm-to-table movement. But in fact, they're like the hummers of the vegetable world.
Hummers because they suck up more water and nutrients from the soil than most other vegetables.
So while we think of a local heirloom tomato as incredibly sustainable and the model of what farm-to-table eating is all about, in the end of the day, what we need to support is all the farming decisions that went in to give you that great-tasting tomato.
In his new book, The Third Plate, Dan Barber points to one key farming decision, rotation, aimed at enriching the soil. Turns out the most desirable foods, like tomatoes, are rotated with humbler, far less lucrative vegetables, like buckwheat or cowpeas or mustard greens, which could and should, says Dan Barber, be valued and eaten. So the third plate is metaphorically a way of eating. It's a way of putting different sorts of things on the plate or different portions.
Right. It's a way of creating a pattern of eating. I mean, when we think about Italian cuisine, we celebrate the cheese and, you know, tomatoes. But really, the underpinning of Italian cuisine is beans. And that it's that way because beans are leguminous and because they trap nitrogen from the air and they provide it to the soil. And what that does, in essence, is provide you with this great-tasting tomato.
Because the beans have nourished the soil.
Yes, the beans are nitrogen fixers. So they take nitrogen from the air and they implant it in the soil. So they provide this very real function for a great-tasting tomato. In America, the only place that you can really look where that relationship evolved into a pattern of eating is Southern cooking. Dishes like Hop and John, right, which was beans and rice.
And sometimes ham hock.
And ham hock and collards, exactly. Well, you had the beans there because the beans supported the rice, and then the collards were there because they cleansed the soil of the salt. And you had a little bit, a smattering, really, of pork because the pigs roamed the forestry. And so you had this natural ecology, and in a dish, you had everything that supported that ecology. At farm to table, unfortunately, though I'm a card-carrying member of it, I've got a skin in the game here, we're not doing that enough. We were never forced into a pattern of eating that supported the land.
Well, let me just hit the nail on the head here, though, about this. When you offer examples from Southern American cuisine to Italian cuisine, you are offering examples that use meat in a small way. It's part of a much larger mix of ingredients.
Yeah, no, that's true of all cuisines. I mean, there's no cuisine that you can point to that has a 12-ounce center-cut protein as part of their everyday expectation for dinner. That's an American phenomenon.
And that is key to better handling of the environment, better handling of soil, right?
Yeah, we've got to change our expectations of dinner. And I don't think that means less enjoyment of food. I actually think it's more. I mean, actually, a 12-ounce piece of steak, I really enjoy steak, so I'm not maligning a steak dinner. It's one of the great pleasures of life, but it's a pleasure. And the idea that it's an everyday indulgence is a bizarre American agricultural phenomenon that became a cultural phenomenon. It makes no sense. What it is this incredible fertility and abundance that is America. You know, we think of the yeoman farmer, the Thomas Jefferson ideal of what built America, but we were never great farmers in the truest sense of the word. We have great technology and we have great farmers, but farming systems, like the people who came over here weren't landowners. And when they came over here, they were lucky that they had rainfall and they had incredible soils on the East Coast. But when those started to fail, what did we do? We moved west. And we picked up the plows and we moved all the way to California. That's really the short history of our country from an agriculture perspective in the last 200 years. There is a lot to be proud of, but that's truly unsustainable. It's not realistic.
Much of what you describe in the book, it's a return to the natural. But in a visit to Spain, you eat foie gras. And you know how controversial foie gras has become. It's even banned here in California. And yet you talk about how natural it is. How so?
Well, I met a farmer that is raising geese that is producing foie gras with this incredible flavor. This farmer, Eduardo Souza, since 1812, his family, been raising this unbelievably delicious foie gras based on a natural system. So there's no force feeding. So all the controversy of the foie gras just slips away. And if the ecology is right, if the farming system is right, the geese eat whatever they're presented with, and they fatten really well, and they produce these livers that, like, you wouldn't believe. And so what it taught me is sort of a parable for agriculture in general, which is that if we feed the system, we end up getting all these bonuses, nature's bonuses. And that's the kind of stuff that we need to support. You know, that's the problem with farm-to-table. It's too passive. It allows us to cherry-pick what we want for dinner when, in fact, what we need to do is look to a system of agriculture that puts it all together. And I think chefs are in this, like, unique position to do that because they curate flavors and they really curate, in the end, a culture. And then I think it can permeate the everyday eating habits of Americans. And that's a very exciting and delicious future.
Dan Barber, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Renee Montaigne.
It was a pleasure. Dan Barber's new book is called The Third Plate, Field Notes on the Future of Food.
40 years ago, in mid-May 1974, Elizabeth Drew, the Washington correspondent of The New Yorker, wrote this in her journal. Rumors went around the Capitol today that the president was resigning. The Capitol, she observed, was noisy and edgy, and in the hothouse atmosphere, the rumors burst into full bloom. By August 1974, the president in question, Richard Nixon, would resign rather than face impeachment and a trial in the Senate. Elizabeth Drew's book, Washington Journal, recounted Nixon's demise when it came out the following year. It's now been reissued with a new 10,000-word afterword, and Elizabeth Drew joins us now. Welcome to the program.
I'm delighted to be back, Robert.
And one of the things that you write about in the afterword is Richard Nixon's plan to rehabilitate himself. Here he was. He'd resigned from the presidency in disgrace, and then came a plan, which you say was called Wizard. What was Wizard all about?
Wizard was how would Nixon get his reputation back? I don't think there are very many people who could have taken the crushing blow that Richard Nixon took. He had spent so many years trying to be president, and he finally got there in 1968. And then smashingly reelected in 1972. So Wizard was, how do you get respect back? Through being a foreign policy guru, that was the idea.
He did this with very sharp elbows also. You describe a moment when Richard Nixon, by now almost 20 years out of the White House, manages to get Bill Clinton to acknowledge him, Nixon, as a great foreign policy thinker. What happened?
Nixon wanted Clinton to call on him for advice. Russia and China were really Nixon's big achievements, opening relations with China and achieving detente with Russia. And Clinton wasn't too eager to be calling on Nixon. So Nixon got word to Clinton through various channels, unless he calls me for advice on how to deal with Boris Yeltsin at the upcoming summit in Vancouver, I will write an op-ed attacking his conduct of foreign policy. So Clinton called him up, but that wasn't enough. And so more pressure on Clinton. And so finally he had him into the White House, but he managed to do it at night when the press wasn't around, no photographs could be taken. But that's how he operated. That was Nixon.
Richard Nixon, I guess like the English kings who get to be remembered the way that Shakespeare chose to remember them, has been preserved in drama and film in Frost Nixon. And I want to play a line from the movie of that for you, a line that you remark upon in the afterword. Here is a bit of Frank Langella playing Richard Nixon in the David Frost interview.
It was a difficult time. I was caught up in a five-front war against a partisan media, a partisan House of Congress, a partisan Urban Committee. But yes, I will admit there were times I did not fully meet that responsibility, and I was involved in a cover-up, as you call it.
I was involved in a cover-up, as you call it. You remark in the book, and I've been through transcripts and videos of the original interview and the play, and while there's a lot of teary confession in there, he never says, I was involved.
That was
in
a lie. It didn't happen. What Nixon said was the opposite. They just left out some words. David Frost was pressing him to get a confession. By the way, this was all a commercial deal. You know, Nixon got paid a lot of money, $600,000 for agreeing to this. And the more, he also was going to get a cut of the sale. So these men were in business together. But Nixon would go only so far. So what the line was, you're wanting me to say that I was involved in a cover-up. No.
No, yeah. You wanted
me to. So
they
turned it upside down, and that was the sort of the high drama point of the play, except it did, and movie, and it didn't happen.
Ultimately, your explanation of what was going on during all that time, it's a very psychological explanation. It's about this strange man who was in the limelight from the late 1940s until the early 1970s, either reaching for power or holding it.
That the hatreds and the resentment started when he was very young. Mm-hmm. And he was not in the right clubs in high school, and he was not likable. Mm-hmm. It was a very strange...
The astonishing thing is he was president of the United States.
Well, I was going to say, it was a very odd personality to go into politics.
Yeah.
He was awkward. In the end, the fact that he saw people as his enemies, which he'd been doing since he was a child, is what brought him down. But there was a lot of courage in there. I mean, the wizard thing, the fact that he could pick himself up, there was a certain nobility in that.
Elizabeth Drew, thanks a lot for talking
Robert,
with us.
Robert, it's always a pleasure.
And we've been talking about the reissue with a new afterword of Elizabeth Drew's book, Washington Journal, Reporting Watergate and Richard Nixon's Downfall. On April 18, 1983, President Ronald Reagan addressed the nation about news that had broken earlier that morning in Lebanon.
As you know, our embassy in Beirut was the target this morning of a vicious terrorist bombing. This cowardly act has claimed a number of killed and wounded. It appears that there are some American casualties, but we don't know yet the exact number or the extent of injury.
As the writer Kai Bird sums it up in his new book, the truck bombing killed 63 people and injured some 120. Among the Americans killed was Robert Ames, the subject of Kai Bird's book, The Good Spy. Ames was the CIA's top Arabist, one who defied many stereotypes about that trade. He was a field agent turned analyst who had opened a back channel to the intelligence chief of the Palestine Liberation Organization at a time when both the organization and his contact were officially regarded as terrorists. Kai Bird joins us. Welcome.
Thank you, Robert. It's great to be here.
And let's start with Ames. What's so important about Ames's work for the CIA that you were drawn to write a book about him?
Well, first of all, I was drawn to him because I knew him. When I was 12 and 13 years old, he was our next-door neighbor in Dahran, Saudi Arabia, where my father was a Foreign Service officer stationed there. Of course, I didn't know that he was a CIA officer at the time. My father did, of course, but I just had these vivid memories of this tall, handsome, blue-eyed fellow who often played basketball with the Marines guarding the consulate compound at the time. And then later on, I heard about his horrible death in Beirut and this truck bombing. But he also turned out to have been extremely important in creating this back-channel, highly clandestine relationship with Ali Hassan Salameh, the intelligence chief for Yasser Arafat, at a time when no American diplomats could talk to the Palestinians.
Tell us more about who Ali Hassan Salameh was.
Well, he was known sort of casually as the Red Prince. He was rather dashing, wore black leather jackets, gold chains, drove fast cars, loved good wine and beautiful women, very much an extrovert and a brilliant tactician. And Ames initially tried to recruit him, but quickly realized that he was the kind of source who was unrecruitable, but might be extremely valuable to get to know. And he turned the relationship into a genuine friendship.
Many people thought that Ali Hassan Salameh was number two to Yasser Arafat in the PLO back in those days. Many people also said he had a lot of blood on his hands.
Both true. This is a complicated relationship, but this is what good spies do. They get close to bad guys to understand them, sometimes to recruit them for information, And sometimes, in the case of Ames, it was to steer them in a different direction. And that was Ames's, as the relationship evolved, he encouraged Ali Hassan Salameh to encourage Arafat to think more about laying down the guns and achieving their Palestinian aspirations through political negotiations and heading towards a two-state solution.
There is a real-life intelligence drama at the core of your book, which has also been treated by fiction writers, among them David Ignatius in one of his books. It involves Ali Hassan Salameh, the CIA, and the Mossad, the Israeli spy service. A Mossad guy goes to a CIA man and says, Ali Hassan Salameh, is he your man? Explain what's going on at that moment.
Well, the Mossad had the belief and some evidence that Ali Hassan was close to Black September and was involved in the Munich tragedy where 11 Israeli athletes were killed brutally in Munich in 1972.
At the Olympics.
And so ever since that happened, they put him on a hit list, and they attempted to assassinate him on at least three occasions and failed. And in 1978, they reopened the case, and they went to the CIA and asked, is he your man? Mm-hmm. Well, this presented the agency with a dilemma. Do they say, yes, he's our man, or do they say no? And in the end, they decided that the best answer was no answer.
It was a green light.
It was a green light. And by saying neither no nor yes, they hoped to sort of fudge it. But Ames was quite upset at the time with this response, and he warned Ali Hassan to beef up his security. But in January of 1979, indeed, 15 Mossad agents snuck into Beirut and launched an operation, and a car bomb killed him in January of 79.
Ames, meanwhile, sympathetic to the Palestinians as he was, had very good relations with the Mossad, it seems, too.
Yes, he traveled to Tel Aviv once a year, sometimes twice a year, had meetings with his counterparts, and he understood. He was a good spy, actually, because he could empathize with people. You know, he was a good spy because he was no James Bond. He had to carry a gun at times, but he hated doing so. And he was the kind of CIA officer who made friendships with people around him, not enemies.
Ultimately, Ames died in that truck bombing of the U.S. Embassy, and you addressed the question, who did it? So, who did it?
Well, it is very clear that it was an operation by Iranian intelligence. And the extraordinary thing that I have discovered and pieced together at the end of my book is I actually name some of the intelligence officers from Iran who put together this truck bomb operation. And one of the chief masterminds was a man named Ali Reza Askari, and he defected to America in 2007 and was brought here apparently by the CIA and given asylum, even though he was directly responsible for the deaths of 8 CIA officers in Beirut and many, many other Americans in Beirut, including over 240 U.S. Marines in the October 83 truck bombing attack.
On the one hand, you read this at the end of your book, and your blood boils a bit, that this is defiling the memory of Ames and all the other Americans who were killed by Askari. On the other hand, your description of Ames is that he was capable of seeing bloodshed, of being quite aware of killing, and regarding it as something that happened in the field that he chose to work.
Yes, you know, and again, this is another reason why he was a good spy. He understood that the world was complicated. And, you know, we've read a lot recently about how supposedly the NSA and wiretap and intercept intelligence is so important to our national security. But I would argue that when you read The Good Spy, you understand that human intelligence is far more important. The ability to form relationships with people who have good information will ultimately keep us safer in this world.
Well, Kai Bird, thanks for talking with us about the book.
Thank you.
Kai Bird's book about the late Central Intelligence Officer Robert Ames is called The Good Spy.
K kids can be pretty tough to impress. Sarah Albee knows this well. She's a children's author, and when she dropped by a public radio member station recently, she brought along three of her young readers, ages 11, 12, and 13. They were all visiting a studio for the first time.
I never imagined it to look like this. I kind of imagined like a big...
Bigger.
Yeah.
You kind of imagined it to be a bit more like, a bit more splendor.
Yeah.
You just expected to look more like a set for Jimmy Fallon or something.
Exactly.
That's Maya Kumar, Sophia Medeiros, and Robert Clifford. They're a tough crowd, including for Sarah Albee, who's been trying to get these and other middle schoolers interested in history. Her strategy? To look at the past through the lens of something that gets kids' attention. Gross stuff. Her first history book was called Poop Happened, A History of the World from the Bottom Up.
I think the middle school brain likes skeevy stuff. I think that...
We do.
Yeah.
Sarah Albee has been fascinated by gross stuff as well for quite a while. Her latest book begins with an apology to her family.
The apology and the dedication to my kids, I think they just have gotten used to having a mom who really likes weird, offbeat topics. And they would get this stricken look on their face when I started talking about it at the dinner table.
I got to hear one of the facts that you just suddenly announced during supper.
Well, let's go with sanitation. I would ask, how would a man in a suit of armor go to the bathroom? And do you want to know the answer, David?
I would love to know the answer, yeah.
Well, suits of armor, of course, they changed style from century to century, and many of them did come with trap doors and buckles and things. But if you're up on your horse and you're in the middle of a battle and mm-hmm. people are trying to cut your head off, you're not going to get down off your horse and go behind a tree.
You're not going to operate that trap door and make
things neat and tidy. No, you're just going to go. And it would be the job of an arming squire, probably someone about Rob's age, to clean the armor after the battle.
Rob, how you feeling about that?
Glad I live now.
The new book that Sarah Albee has out is about a different topic. It is called Bugged, How Insects Changed History.
Insects have killed more soldiers in wars than have swords and guns. And I think that's kind of a cool fact that I think a lot of grown-ups don't know, and certainly a lot of kids don't realize, that they really did determine the outcomes of many, many wars. Half a million of Napoleon's soldiers died of typhus and related bug-borne diseases.
If you just page through this book, it is full of fascinating bug facts about the role insects have played in science, in spreading disease, in determining the course of conflicts. We asked the kids to read some of their favorite parts from the book. 11-year-old Maya Kumar got us started.
Many foods and drinks that come in bright shades of red, orange, pink, and purple get their color from crushed bug carcasses.
So, Maya, you're telling me that there are bug carcasses in a lot of what I'm eating.
Basically, yes. Yeah, basically.
And are you feeling good about that?
Not really.
Entomophagy is a section of the book as well, which means eating insects on purpose.
Right.
And it has a long and esteemed history. The ancient Greeks and Romans, bugs were a big part of their diet. I think the Romans preferred them roasted and crunchy, and the Greeks preferred them soft and mushy. But it's a really good source of protein, and in many parts of the world, they're a big part of people's diets.
Sophia or Rob, do you have a favorite passage from the book?
I have a passage about, like, the yellow fever, which is really kind of...
Okay.
Yeah.
Go for it, Sophia.
Okay. Yellow fever starts with a blinding headache and painful sensitivity to light, followed by high fever. In serious cases, the virus attacks the liver, which causes the skin to turn bright yellow. The kidneys stop functioning, which poisons the body and causes the victim to bleed internally. Death often follows. The yellow skin tone of victims earned the disease nickname Yellow Jack.
I'm thinking we all want to avoid getting yellow fever.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
A little bit, yeah.
And Sarah, yellow fever is spread by bugs?
It is spread by a mosquito, mm-hmm. Not the same one that spreads malaria, that vectors malaria. But yes, it's called Aedes aegypti, which means unpleasant Egyptian.
One more piece of history I had to ask you about. You have argued that bugs are the reason that we got the Louisiana Purchase, and actually the reason that a big part of the United States is the United States.
That's right. When Napoleon was trying to put down this insurrection in Haiti in the early 1800s, he sent all these soldiers over to fight the Haitians. There was an uprising. And lo and behold, 40,000 of them just up and died, mostly from yellow fever and also malaria. And at that point, they didn't know what caused the disease. He just knew that this was a really buggy place. And so he really lost interest in the southern portion of what would become the United States. So he sold it to the Americans for, I think, 4 cents an acre. The country was suddenly a third bigger. Mm-hmm. So it allowed westward expansion and Lewis and Clark, and the rest is history.
The rest is history. And you're saying if the place had not been so buggy, this never would have happened.
Absolutely. And it still was buggy. I mean, they're hilariously awful accounts that Lewis and Clark, as they were exploring this new Western territory, they did bring lots of grease with them to slather their bodies to protect them from insects. But they had to eat their lunch and dinner in the smoke of the campfire just so they wouldn't eat too many mosquitoes.
You know, you pack your book with a lot of history, a lot of facts. Why not do it as something other than a children's book? Why do you decide to do a book for kids?
Because I love writing for kids, and a lot of us children's book writers get asked all the time, when are you going to write a book for grown-ups? And I think every children's book writer has an inner child and a voice if they find that voice, that's where their best writing is. And my inner child is 12 years old. I just think I think like a 12-year-old. I think toilet jokes are funny. I think bugs and skeevy stuff is really cool. I just love this age so much, and I love to write for them.
Well, Sarah, Rob, Maya, Sophia, thank you all for coming and talking to us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Sarah Albee's new book is called Bugged, How Insects Changed History. And I got to say, these kids, they seem pretty comfortable behind the microphone.
No controls
here. No
beatboxing.
Yeah, no beatboxing.
Yeah, okay.
Beatboxing in the studio. I never thought of that as an option. Pretty exciting. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Greene.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
This is Fresh Air. Francine Prose's latest novel, called Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris 1932, was inspired by a photograph and the strange backstory of one of the women in it. But critic Maureen Carrigan has a review.
Even the most restrained plot summary of Francine Prose's latest novel sounds like a teaser for a Lifetime TV movie, Late Night Edition. Here goes. In the Paris of the late 1920s, a butch lesbian race car driver named Lou Villars has her license revoked by the French government for daring to dress as a man in public. Lou goes on to become a performer in a risque revue at the Chameleon Club, a smoky nightclub where threadbare artists and thrill-seeking aristocrats mingle in the half-light. Hitler rises to power. And through an acquaintance on the old race car circuit, Lou is invited to be his special guest at the 1936 Olympics. There, she's recruited as a spy for Germany. In occupied Paris, she works as a Nazi collaborator and torturer. Late in the war, on a lonely road in the French countryside, Lou Villars receives her just desserts at the hands of the French resistance. Phew! That's a whopper of a tale from a writer who's known for championing a sophisticated literary style over the more pedestrian pleasures of storytelling. Prose aims to have it both ways in this new novel called Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. She gives us that big story, but she tells it in intricate fashion through jarring and sometimes contradictory testimony in the form of letters, memoirs left behind by supporting characters, a novel authored by a naughty novelist modeled on Henry Miller, and a contemporary biography of Lou Villars written by a feminist scholar. All these documents are fictitious, of course, but the central plot of Prose's novel is based in fact. Prose says she was inspired by a black-and-white photograph called Lesbian Couple at Le Monocle, 1932, taken by the Hungarian-born French photographer Brassai. The woman in that photograph, who's sporting short hair and a tuxedo, was a professional athlete named Violette Morris. She worked for the Gestapo during the German occupation of Paris. The character of a male photographer here, named Gabor, is modeled on Brassai. Prose herself has always struck me as a cool writer who appeals more to the brain than the heart. Indeed, sometimes I've found her novels, accomplished as they are, to be somewhat too preoccupied with seminar questions about the nature of truth and identity. That philosophical detachment works in Prose's favor here. This story is so lurid that it needs to be toned down by some gray matter. Accordingly, she scatters provocative ruminations throughout the novel. The young Gabor, for instance, immerses himself in the sleazy glamour of Paris, as did Brassai. He takes photos of prostitutes, cabaret singers, and criminals. But in the late 30s, when those photographs become celebrated as art in museum exhibitions, Gabor wonders about the temporal source of their higher value. Could it be, he asks in a letter to his parents, that everyone suddenly wants photographs of Paris because they fear that this eternally beautiful city may not be so eternal? What if Hitler isn't just bluffing? Lionel Mayne, the character modeled on Henry Miller, is also given to bouts of contemplation, but happily his are much raunchier in nature. Describing himself as a sexual Columbus, he celebrates with great anatomical specificity the hedonism and variety of experience offered by pre-World War II Paris. In tone and time period, voice and ideas, Lovers at the Chameleon Club tries itself to be something of a chameleon of a novel. Prose, I dare say, wants to consider the mystery of evil, embodied by the story of Lou Villars and her puzzling veer over to the dark side of history. But it's no knock on this novel to declare that it mostly reads as a good story, an ingenious excursion into the Parisian demi-monde. Prose here concocts a bright confection, a light but genuine pleasure.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932, by Francine Prose. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Yue Shaw. I'm Terry Gross.